I went back and counted the number of talks so far in this series. We've had 30. I just feel like I'm getting started. And we're currently in this Satipatthana Sutta looking at fleshing out the mind, what it's about, and looking at the different states of mind that formulate around different propensities that we have, certain tendencies that we have. And these groupings are large groupings of states of mind. In fact, many of them contain a combination of different states. They're not single states in themselves. Like, for instance, tonight we're going to be talking about division through judgment, judging mind. Well, often in the judging mind, there's also the doubting mind. There's the inadequate mind. There's sometimes the angry mind, sometimes on and on. Fearful mind. So these things shouldn't be seen as being entities in themselves, but rather opportunities to look at particular patterns in us that come forward. And when they come forward, they have such a compelling nature, often a defensive nature, because we use them as a way to defend ourselves from a pain that we are loath to acknowledge. And we then move out into these tendencies, full-blown, fully created, fully substantiated in our story, in our narrative, in our combative attitude, if that's our tendency, or in our unworthy, withering attitude, which if we have a tendency to go back the other way, just depends. And very defined, very isolated within that state. So it's important to understand these states, because it is through these states that we come into our sense of separation and isolation from one another. Often, most emphatically, when these states arise, we may have a lingering tendency to come out or to move into isolation just in the course of the day, but when these states come out, we are very, very defined and very on guard against the world. And it's that defensive quality, that sense of being in combat with something, or there's a sort of a war that we feel, a boundary, a force that's being created there, that these states of mind seem to insist upon. So what is it that we are to do? Because they're saying, behave as if you were me. These states arise. They're just states. It's amazing to me. What is a state? It's a thought. It's an attitudinal direction. It has a thought and a basis of history and memory. And when you have the billions of neurons firing simultaneously, each of them carrying a bit of information about yourself in relationship to the conditions that are arising in this moment, these states come out, and we invest in these states, and they come out as me. And we have no, we don't really have any tendency to go and see what they are. We just act them out. We just play them out. We just, who's ever in front of us, when one of these states arises, they get fed by these states. Our state feeds upon whatever it needs to feed upon, often to the detriment of that relationship, and then it can go back in and quiet down and feel well fed. But what are they? I mean, what we as spiritual seekers want to have a different understanding to our mind. We don't want to just be automatically reactive as these states explode upon the stage of our being. We want to know what these states are. We have to go underneath the reactivity. We have to begin to flesh out what's contained in these states. And may I say, and I've said before, but it's important to reinforce, that it's through understanding that these states become neutralized, so to speak. We have invested so much of our belief system into these states. We believe them to be something that they can never, ever be once we start looking at them. As we start bringing our conscious attention to them, they wither under our observation, and they can't maintain that sense of embodied energy that could only be whose momentum rested upon us not looking at them. So the first thing we have to do is to actually take these apart, and they're not states that we want to take apart. They're states that are often very contagious within us. And not only contagious within us, but when other people see us on display, it touches that state in them and gives them some kind of okayness to display that state as well. Have you ever noticed what happens around a water cooler? Or wherever you might be, you know, harboring your extra time? You go and you meet a few people and you start talking about the boss or situations or the politics or government or something, and then the people who resonate with the energy of that negativity stay at the water cooler, the rest of the people go away. And then it starts getting just going down, doesn't it? It's like a waterfall effect, and each encouraging the other towards that particular perspective. And it has a contagious quality to it. And so if we begin to think, oh, you know, we're alone in this, because the state of mind feels us alone, we love to have company with other people who are in the same state of mind. So we breed that ill contempt so that we will have companionship in it. We just give ourselves away to these states. The mind state itself is not the enemy. So let us not set up a new aversive relationship to these states of mind. But less understanding doesn't have a negative relationship to anything. It's to understand something is to neutralize whatever relationship we already have. Through understanding, we no longer carry forth the negativity that we initially had for it. So this understanding is a very important part of it. And part of that understanding, and many people seek some sanity through therapy, and I think it's a very important way for many people who are interested in mental health to have therapeutic intervention. Therapy at its best will bring these emotions up to the surface so that they can be felt and acknowledged within the gaze of somebody else's non-judgment. But the difference really between what we're trying to do here in therapy, and this is not a disparaging comment on therapy, but it's to show that we have to move further than where the therapeutic intervention usually contains us, and that is that therapy in I think often has a modification of the story about ourselves as we acknowledge our history, and as we come to terms with the reactivity that's in us, we change our story a little bit. We change the narrative. Well, what we're interested in doing in spiritual work is ending the narrative, being absolutely still in ourselves. Because there's nowhere else to move. There's nowhere else that we need to move. We only move when we are in some kind of disquieting or uncomfortable or a sense of ourselves as being incomplete. We'll move on. So unless we come to this base sense of who we are within these states of mind, they will just fester into permutations of themselves and move out into other areas with perhaps a quieter or a more gentle narrative, but with the sense of I still very much in place. So we're going really to the depths, calling ourselves back to the depths of our being here. But then what is spirituality about? But to see what this thing is, to really look at what this 6-foot-long tube is that walks around, to see what this thing, what makes it go? Why are we assuming what we assume? What's going on here? And to notice in how the mind, you know, in its most enlightened moments, in its most restful moments, in its most completed moments, has a sense of unity about it. It's not separated as fractured in any way and contesting each other's point of view, which is what our mind often does. We have an experience and then part of us doesn't like what is occurring and has a counter argument to what is occurring, and that kind of constant contest and argument and resistance goes on all the time. And that's, that sense of unity is lost as soon as there's a pull-out point and an argument towards a particular experience we're having. What we're trying to do is come back to unity. Now, a unified mind is a quiet mind. Okay, a noisy mind is a mind that generates a sense of me and the against or for the experience I'm having. But a quiet mind is a unified mind, and a unified mind doesn't contain that pull-out position, that sense of isolation. And so what we're doing as we are fleshing out these states of mind in all of its different forms and looking at them and showing some sincerity and going into them, being willing and having the courage to go into them, is we're coming back to a unified mind. Coming back to, like, you know how the, what do you call those things that, the pendulum. The pendulum comes to a rest, finally. And how does it become unrested or disquieted? A feeling comes up, a pleasant, an unpleasant, or a neutral. Something entices it out of its unity. And in that moment, it says, I'd rather have pleasure than unity. What the hell's good is unity? And in order to have pleasure, we have to embody a sense of separation in order to have, right? You can't have something unless there's you that can grab it. And so you have to come into your, we have to come into ourselves in a complete representation of form to pursue, to pursue. Now it's very interesting what we pursue. Since everything is here, what we pursue is a future. Because that isn't here, is it? And so very much tied to this sense of separation out of unity is time. Time to meet my needs, time to acquire what it is I need to acquire, time to reach and indulge in the pleasure now that I'm feeling, time to really feel the indulgence of my life, on and on. Unity doesn't have that privilege. Unity is based in reality. It's not in any way separate from reality, and therefore it can't pull itself out of reality. Nor does it have any tendency or want to do so. Why doesn't it? Because it has seen the limitation of doing so after how many eons of having done it. How many times do we have to put our finger in the fire before we say, this isn't the most skillful action I've ever done? And when we get a sense that, when we start looking in a wise way, we begin to see how it is that we create the pain of our life through the pulling out and separation of our life. And we just say, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. And so that's a, there's a deep resonance that comes in meditation. Meditation is the beginning of the process of returning to that unity. Why would you want to sit and do nothing? You see, it already shows a maturity of an appreciation for silence. It already shows an inclination towards unity, towards coming back, towards being settled. And even if you sit for, you know, not for a very long time, still, it gets you, doesn't it? There's something in it, and you don't do it for a while, you start missing it, or some part of you just feels undernourished. And it's that part, when you come here, hopefully, that we do nourish, that we do encourage. Because that's the part that yearns for, longs for, that sense of reconnection. And so we reconnect our way all the way back to unity. Now, what does reconnection look like? It looks like reconnecting. So when these states of mind come up, we don't act them out. That's not reconnecting with them. Reacting to them, playing them out, is complete ignorance of them. It's just letting them have their day with my body and mind. I'm a puppet to them. Reconnecting means feeling them again. Instead of just reacting to them, let's feel them. Let's go into them. Let's decipher every level of this thing. Let me feel every tendency I have. And in that, I come back into a kind of stillness with that mind through understanding. And now back to unity and back to a quietude. But I will never come back to that quietude as long as I stay reactive to these states. That's why we're looking at these states. That's why we're looking into these states. And these states, I hope everyone can identify with, can sense that they're in you. And tonight, the state of judgment, I hope, is not too alien to any of you. Because once we resist and pull out what judgment is, when that sense of resisting the experience at hand, judgment is the verbalization of that resistance, internally or externally. I shouldn't, I can't. That's all. Really has its basis in just about everything we do. It's the mind that is contesting its own experience through resistance and giving verbalization to that through judgment. Now, there's extraordinary subtlety in judgment. Every thought. And I just want to take you to the subtlety here so that we begin to see how pervasive judgment is in us. But every thought that we have turns us in a certain way, and anything that turns us in a certain way turns us against another way. In this case, unity, or whatever it is that where the judgment might be persuading. And so every word, every thought is itself a form of judgment. And so we're always leaning in accordance to the words we're offering the life we're living. And if those words are energetic and have a lot of infusion of energy, then they're going to have not just a sentence of narrative, but an emotional response to that situation as well. And so then those emotions will then foster further thoughts, and those thoughts will foster further reactive emotions. And those two just feed each other like that. So we're looking at this sense of judgment, and we have to get a sense that behind judgment is unseen pain. Any time we react, I mean, I hope you know this by now. I mean, I'm kind of reviewing, right? So we've been doing this for 30 talks. My hope is that something's gotten in there. Because, this has a common thread through all of these 30 talks. There's a common thread here. And this sense of reactivity, when we react, we're reacting away from something. Something has struck a chord in us. That chord almost always has to do with some issue of pain in ourselves. And so the response or overcompensation of that pain is the reactive response, in this case, judgment. So judgment is a symptom of a deeper level of pain in us, a much deeper level of pain. And now judgment, just to make it so that we don't feel so shameful of the judgment we carry, because all of us carry an enormous amount of judgment. In fact, on retreat, next to knee pain, that's the most important experience that's relayed as problematic. Oh, I have so much judgment. But that judgment isn't just on retreat, it's all the time. If you just look around, almost everywhere your mind lights, there's some form of judgment that's arising. And so it's important for us to get a sense that there's a childhood induction into judgment that each of us go through in terms of our family history. You don't have to search too far to get a sense of what that history was like for you and why you hold often the prejudices that you hold now. You know, what is it that was valued in your family and disvalued? And how was themes like gender and money and status and ethnic groups, how was that seen and even non-verbally and understood within your family and communicated in your family? And when you're small, you just assume the nature of the world of the adult and you just start seeing the world from that. And after a while, it becomes the home base for us to grow in terms of our sense of self, our sense of righteousness, our sense of ideas of self. And then there comes a whole emotional and attitudinal fix that those judgments begin to hold over time. But that's basically where judgment starts. And if you want to look at self-judgment, the question I would ask you is, you know, how were you spoken to as a child? What ways were you accepted or not accepted as a child? And those particular invested conversations and communication strategies became incorporated in how we have hold ourselves in terms of our own sense of self-worth. So get a sense of that this is a long-standing and very enduring tendency in us. Now what we have to do as in spiritual journey is to not just weigh heavily upon where they came from and say, oh, you know, it's all my parents and all that. We stay accountable to the feelings that we have because we've incorporated them. Your parents were no more responsible for their judgment than you are. We each just pass it along generation after generation, and whatever your family's psychic system was, we take that psychic system outside when we leave our family, especially if we have a reaction, strong reaction, either positive or negative, to the parents within that family. We will carry it even heavier, and we'll carry it often. We don't even realize we're carrying it, but we carry it with us from our aversion or our attachment to those particular parental styles. So it's important to get a sense that they're there, to be honest with them and be accountable. Don't let their voice of your mother take you to the relationship of aversion that you might have with your mother. Just listen to that voice. Oh, my mother used to say that. Or you just let that sit there with you. And then as you sit there with you, you have to be accountable. We have to be accountable for it. We can't, all that, you know, I can't stand this voice within. No, it's in you. We have to be accountable to it. So let's just open up and listen to this thing. It's now your voice. And if you have children, likely you're passing it on to them and they'll do the same to theirs. So let's look at this thing. And that accountability allows us to end the chain of events which hands it off from one generation to the next. If you say, this will stop with me because I will be accountable to it, instead of just passing through reactivity to the next generation, it will stop with you. It will stop with you. But how many of us are willing to be accountable to those that the sense of worth within us or the voices of judgment within us? It's so much easier to blame them away, isn't it? To just excuse them. To say, well, it's not me, even though it's in you. It really wasn't something I wanted, which may be true, but it's something you've got. You own it now. And it has to be completely uprooted through our understanding. Now, as I start going into judgment, I want to talk about three reasons that we should even want to explore judgment. The first reason is that judgment is seeing the world in quantifiable terms. And you may not understand the impact that quantifiable terms have on you, but when you start looking at the polar opposites of life, those have often take their root in forms of judgment, moralism. And the tensions that we create from the judgments that we assert and the polarities that are created through that infusion of justice, of judgment, into each and everything. And if we have something that we're neutral about, we feel a kind of confused. It's not clear, you know, that everyone's supposed to have an opinion about something, and so forming judgments in this culture is almost contagious as well. And so most of us have judgments about everything, and if we don't, we quickly form them just to have be on the right side or the wrong side, according to our inward map of polarities. And so these polar opposites weigh in tremendously on the stress and resistance that we each carry with us throughout our life. And it's induced, the vision of that, the perception of that, comes from this constant need to judge each and everything that we see. And so, all right, so that's not a very pleasant aspect of judging. Let me, it's again, it's the unseen pain of judgment. And especially, you know, it's what we think of when we quantify something is that there's only a certain amount available. And often, because we have a sense of an ongoing sense of inadequacy, we got left out of the whatever quantity we're assessing. Contentment, quiet, calm, peace, samadhi, I don't know, we're full of being left out in the spiritual world. And it's because we think we just didn't get our share of it. We didn't get our share. And I'm not up to the task. See, when we think, well, I could always cultivate it. No, I'm not. I can't do that. I'm just not. I can't do that. So we meet everything, our judgments. It just keeps going. I hope you all see the lineage of insanity here. It's the lineage of insanity. And spiritually, we do the same thing. We carry a judgment spiritually, you know. Gosh, she sits so well, you know. Like that's some kind of proclamation of their wisdom. Or, God, she was in my group and she said something so wise. I'm not that wise. And I can't sit that long. And then pretty soon you just implode. Yeah, I'll tell you a story where I imploded. So I was into, you know, like hour sitting and all that. So I was a monk and I was going to sit straighter and better and stiller and quieter and longer than. So I went to this monastery as a new monk. I was a very young monk. I went to this monastery and this guy that was sitting beside me it wasn't moving, and the bell was rung and he still wasn't moving, and we went throughout our day, and he still wasn't moving. He was just sitting there. I thought, my God, what is the story about this guy? Well, I asked another monk. I said, who is this monk, this Thai monk who never moves? The story of him is that he had just come out of a three-year retreat in which he resolved that he was not going to get up from sitting except once a day to toilet and shower. So this monk sat for 3 years, and so I caught him right when he was coming out of retreat, and he was happened to be sitting next to me, and the guy never moved. He could have done another 3-year retreat, because I don't know, he was just amazing. So at that point I realized I was not in competition any longer. I wasn't going to win this one. I don't care how much how I tried, how much I invested in that one. And so it showed me something. It showed me that, you know, it's not about that at all. In fact, it might have worked for him, but if I had tried to do that, it would have sent me into a very heightened state of arrogance, right? And I would have come out of 3 years with a masterly sense of control. But I'm not sure that would have been very helpful to me. So we have to pick our procedures, our techniques, our practices in accordance to our own inward tendencies, into our own. But if those inward tendencies, it's not just following our inward tendencies and doing whatever our mind tells us to do, We want to look and see what those tendencies are in ourselves. Get a new life with them. See them afresh and anew. Okay, so that's the first reason we want to look at judgment, is because it's a world of quantifiable terms, and that when that is just left to run on its own, it polarizes virtually all opposites in the world. And then we take a judgmental tone with one side of that opposite versus the other. The other is that it's a symptom of pain, and judgment is driven by pain. For a number of years, I just set in my teachers would say, just be with judging, be with a judging mind, judging, judging, you know, you just be with judging. But it just continued. I never saw any, it was unrelenting. And I thought, wait a minute here. Let's go back a little bit. What's happening at the moment of judgment? At the moment of judgment, what's going on? Let me look at what's happening at the moment of judgment. And what I could see, what I began to see, was, now it's extraordinarily subtle, but in the moment of judgment in which we go out and judge, in the moment right before we go out, knee-jerk out, there's a sense of an assumed identity, an assumption, self-assumption that we feel about ourselves. There's a pain spark. It's the spark plug that gets us to move out into judgment. It's we're feeling in that instant, right before judgment or during judgment sometimes, this sense of something lacking in ourselves. Now, what does a judgment do? Judgment allows me to have some space to that problematic image that hurts. So I have to just lower your head to be able to raise mine, right? Now I'm raise up above the pain of what I feel about myself by lowering you in my evaluation of you, lowering you down. So the problem is that as soon as I stop judging, it gets reversed again. And so that's why judging is a continuous process. We keep trying to keep this thing to our advantage. And what happens is that after a while, the differences become obvious to you. You bring somebody's head down, your head is raised up, but you don't really believe that you're above where everyone else is. And so there's a greater discrepancy between the assumption you know about yourself and where you're elevated teeter-totter resides. And so when it comes down again, now you've got to be more boisterous in your judgment to get it back up so that you can even be higher than you were, you see. So there's this infusion of dynamic and energy into keeping the judgment going ever more emphatically so that we can feel the relief that we want to feel through the judgment itself. Now, that's pretty tiring. And you begin to sense, wow, you know, this thing, this just doesn't end. It doesn't end. But you've got to be, you see, we're not necessarily aware of that we're even doing that because we're in pain. We have so long looked outside, external, not internally, to see where the pain resides, but external to see where the judgment goes, that we really believe that life deserves the judgment we're giving it. It's just a part of who I am in terms of life. And yes, I have, when I judge, I have a kind of righteous indignation and arrogance, but that's the way I feel good about myself. And they deserve to be judged. And in a convoluted way of thinking, we then make life deserving of being judged. And we don't even see the connection to our own pain. Pain's never touched. So there's enormous amount of pain. Now, there's also a payoff to judgment. You know, we can't skip by. I never want to skip by any reactive pattern without seeing the payoff of what it's doing for us. And I've already mentioned what it's doing for us is that it gives us a very strong definition of ourselves. And that is a saving grace of all of the dynamics, all of these emotional dynamics within us, is that there's a payoff to it. And we put so much value into the payoff because we're so afraid of the truth of the pain that we just keep this judgment going in order to have payoff after payoff. But it's firing caps, blanks, blanks. It never convinces us, in other words. It never convinces us that the pain we feel isn't the truth. And in a moment of a task, we can feel it often, you know, where we feel incompetent to the task at hand, where we feel unworthy of what, you know, all of that. It comes in, and then we scramble. We're in scramble mode, you know. We get to the scramble the jets, you know, that, and all of a sudden, you know, we're on high alert for some way to counteract this pain we're feeling. Sometimes it's done through kind of an angry overcompensation, a blame, but it's always a blame. It can be a self-blame, but it's always a blame. So the payoff of our judgment is positionality. We get a place in things. You have to be awful noisy to have a place. And so we're willing to yell and scream and judge so that we have a place in life. See me? You see me yet? You know? It's quite... So in judging, there's the pain of judgment. In the third Zen patriarch, they say, what does he say? The burdensome act of judging. And it is. It's like just the pain of judging. There's the pain of judging itself. Like, oh, just it feels base and gross. It's just the energy is so thump. You know, it's like, ugh. For someone who lives a life in which unity is a part of that living experience, judgment is intolerable. Judgment's intolerable. And all of us have moments in which we know that relaxed presence before we judge it away. So there's the pain of the judgment. And then, as I mentioned, there's the pain driving the judgment. That's the sense of inadequacy that we feel, that we never quite compensate for, and keeps the judgment forever moving forward. And then there's the pain of the effect of having judged. Right? Because it's not after you've judged the world, if you look at it from any sane way, it doesn't come back very connected. You may get your arrogance out of it. You may feel deserving. But that's not a pleasant feeling. And in fact, many of the states that we think are pleasant when really scrutinized aren't very pleasant at all, and that certainly is one of them. And you begin to think, wow, oh God. Because it's so distant. We think we were cut off before. After judgment, we feel so isolated, we feel like an island in ourselves. And so these three issues of pain, the pain of judgment, of judging, the pain that leads to judgment that we carry with us, and the effect of us on judging, are the three sisters of judgment. And again, you know, it hurts. What else can we say about it? It hurts. So we have to reach a threshold in which we have decided we've had enough. Now, a lot of what I'm doing is encouraging us towards that threshold. I bring up these very difficult subjects. It's not easy to sit and listen to this, because if you're following it experientially, you're feeling the pain that is lying back there in wait to judge. But I want to take you there. And I'm not doing this in any kind of malicious sense. I'm doing this because unless we see that, unless we touch it, it'll stay kind of innocuous. We won't even know that it's around. And sometimes as a group, we can come to these deep resolutions of heart to say, okay, I've had enough of this now. Let's move forward in this one. You know, I don't need to keep this going. And then we come to the third and final reason that judgment is so important for us to perceive and to look at, and that is because of how judgment keeps us so ongoingly distant and away from the unity of our hearts. Now, the great threat to the sense of self is stillness, is quietude. Because there's nowhere to rub. There's no rub in silence. If you are cocooned in silence, you have no sense of your own limitation, of your own boundaries, because silence doesn't give you any rub. You only know a boundary when there's a rub, don't you? Like when somebody invades our turf. But in silence, there's no invasion. So you begin to see that judgment serves the noise we need to make in order to be personified. And it counteracts the real enemy here. It's not the inadequacy we feel. We're willing to feel the inadequacy if it keeps us defined, as long as we don't have to encompass ourselves in the silence that gives us no definition at all. So this willingness, this fear of being undefined, is what many of us call emptiness, and it's why we're so afraid of that term. And when we talk about emptiness in this tradition, you know, people get panic attacks. And that panic attack is because they sense that emptiness doesn't allow them a place, honor their place on earth, which couldn't be more untrue. To find our place in unity and be willing to be quiet assures us knowing exactly, having the confidence that arises. See, some other qualities arise in the absence of mental turmoil. And one of them is confidence of being. You simply know where you are. And you, without excuse, without apology. Because it's so clear, it's just so clear. Now, we have to encourage our way towards the understanding of these complex issues. And I can't think of a word that allows exploration more fully than the word relaxation. Are we willing, in the midst of judgment, that our tendency is to move out and confirm the truth of the blame that judgment holds? I mean, there's just that quick. Are we willing? Okay, so wait a minute here. What am I feeling in this moment of judging? What's going on inside me? Go back this way. Don't go out. Go back this way. It's not about them. It's about the pain I'm feeling. Let me feel this. Let me get a sense of this. Does it cue us into a way that we need to look, a depth of understanding that we need to infiltrate, to allow ourselves to come to some sort of resolution within this pain so that judgment just doesn't persist any longer? In fact, it cues us, when there is a judgment, it cues us, okay, not outside, inside. You start using the very markers that led you to an external leap to encourage yourself back in. Okay, let's see. I call those reverse cues because they're reverse in the effects of what they have upon us. And each time we do, it's not that we bring a judgment to what we see. I mean, that in itself is crazy making, to start investing more judgment into what we see that's already shameful enough or inadequate enough. It's to be quiet with what we see, because that's the nature, that's the conduit for understanding. It's an opinion. You can't understand something if you have your opinions about something. All you see is your opinions, right? But when we're quiet with something, then whatever that something is can impart what it is to us. And so being quiet becomes the way we receive our own judgment. And now we're moving judgment towards more stillness, not towards more rancor. Having no sound of self. No sound of self. Not even a peep. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So meet whatever is arising within you with no sound of self. And that includes the sounds that are coming forth on their own. Add nothing to those sounds. You can't stop the thoughts, but you don't have to add to them. No sound of self. Okay, if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to try to respond. Have to speak up. Okay, so she said that her biggest challenge is indulgence, if I can use that word, in pleasurable experiences, right? That you're going to lose out on what it means to be human and the whole array of pleasurable experiences at hand, right? So I'm not in any way suggesting that that's not a strategy that can be used towards coming to a resolution. Whatever our tendency is, we don't want to deny. It's not going to do any good if you just turn your back and just turn your back. I'm not going to do, you know, because that's not going to satisfy the need you feel in pursuing pleasure. What I would invite you to do is to see whether pleasure is as much as you expect it to be. Is the payoff worth the price of your pursuit? Because the practice in no way is anti-pleasure. It doesn't have us turning back on pleasurable experiences. neither does it have us turn our back on unpleasant experiences, but to pursue pleasure has a kind of tension associated with it that isn't just whatever life brings, it's me going out and seeking. That pursuit of pleasure has a toll it's taking on you. It has a cost. Every time we make a decision to go in a particular direction, it has a cost. In fact, pursuing allowing unity has a cost. You understand that? You see, feel the cost of stillness? Well, it's everything. But we're not going to give up everything until we have come to the limitation, until we see that everything isn't worth pursuing. So as long as we aren't interested in quiet, we're interested in pleasure, let's go with our eyes wide open. See whether pleasure gives us what pleasure is supposed to give. See what cost it takes upon us. See how I strive in relationship to other people. See if it doesn't bring about comparison and competition, and see if it doesn't, you know, see how long the pleasure lasts once it does get obtained. See whether it's as delightful as we expected it to be and how long that delight lasts. To see the expense, I mean, right? We drive our car across the country. What was the expense in driving across the country? What about all the gas we had to buy? What about all the, you know, what about all of that? We have to take it all into consideration. And then, through that understanding, there won't be a turning away of pleasure. There'll be a turning away of the pursuit of pleasure. And then when pleasure comes, it's enjoyed fully, but it isn't retained or tried to, we don't try to retain it beyond its natural duration. So it comes and it goes, and you feel pleasure and then you don't. And there's no longing after the comet's tail. It simply is okay to be without it and to be with it. Yes.
Does that type of pleasure feel as good as the kind that we think we're going to get by seeking?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. Does the type of pleasure we feel when we're just available to it, is it as good as the pleasure we partake in when we pursue it? Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. Go ahead. Have you ever tried to mindfully eat? Right? So you know, it's just not quite as good. Because you're being aware. You see, so much of what we consider to be good is the expectation we have of it being good. And we just keep moving. We don't actually taste the food in terms of the enjoyment. We looking for the future, for the next hit we can have that will surmount the one we just had. And so there's this constant expectation of greater pleasure that makes it seem as if there's an elevation of pleasure through the whole event of Thanksgiving meal. So when you're mindful and you're not putting yourself ahead of what you're doing, you're tasting the pleasure that's there, not the pleasure that will be. And so it's like, well, that was okay. You also see it come and go. It doesn't, but it's the truth. That's the truth of the pleasure. That's the truth of it. It's not being compelled into an imaginative truth. It's just the truth of it. So the truth is that the pleasure doesn't match the imaginative anticipation of pleasure that uncontrolled thoughts will allow, but it takes you to the truth of what the pleasure really is, which is it's only this much. It's only this much. Yes. So I just want to go back to your premise, because I don't hold that same premise, that in order to live in this world, we have to have opinions and judgments about it. You see, what most of us, that's the reason, another reason that we compel judgment forward is we think that we would become, I don't know, fill in the blank if we didn't have opinions and judgments, that we'd become what? I don't know.
Boring. But,
you know. You passive or I don't know. What? Oh boy. No, I encourage you to test that theory, because you will never give up your judgments or even relinquish them or even be willing to look at them if you hold that theory. Now, I hold a different orientation, and that is that what comes, the mind's attempts to have everything known to it as being good or bad, moral, immoral, and that's the way it encourages itself forward into events of right or wrong and that sort of thing, right? Through moral judgment and control. So as long as that is the strategy we use, there's another strategy that can never be seen. When you come to quiet, there's the ability to discern. First of all, quiet, as I mentioned in the talk, is unifying. It's not separate. So what comes in when you see in unification terms is a sense of love for things, which holds its own wise action, holds its own speech, holds its own, and I won't use, ethical way of being. That's not moral in the sense it pits one thing against the other, because it's based in love. And it also has a discerning quality that then knows what it needs to do, more spontaneously derived than contrived by a kind of map, a moral map that we place upon things. See, we never get to the depth of that spontaneity of the union, because we're too afraid that if we let go of the contracted way that we keep ourselves motivated through moral judgment, and that those two never meet. They can't ever meet, because to keep yourself morally judged and morally motivated is so noisy that you can't feel the unification of stillness. That is why I say, I send you to the noise, and then you have to wear yourself out through the noise of the mind. When you think your moralism is the way you serve, look at how it bites you back. You know, the tensions you hold. See what it does to you as well. When you hold a moral attitude about anything in yourself, I guarantee you that that behavior has not been uprooted, that it waits in a shadowy form to spring forth. When you are being compromised, you will act it out. That it, by compromise, you let your guard down a little bit. You see, this ethical conduct that I'm talking about is a natural state of seeing in love. You see, so, but as long as you hold, and the most important part of this response is that as long as you hold yourself in that, within that opinion, that I need my moral opinions and my judgments in order to live, you'll never seek anything else. So you have to come to the limitation of that particular paradigm you're in order for you to want to evolve out of it. I can't force that from you. No one else can. You have to see its own limitation. But it's a very good question, and I appreciate that question. Now we'll have to stop. And I want to thank you all. And I want to thank you. I'm going to be gone next week. We're going to be doing a week.